Here we go, sir. We're gonna get started in 1 minute. Everyone, welcome. Very short introduction. This is Dr. Rona Novick, and she is the dean of our Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration.
Novick. Thank you. Thank you for joining us this morning. It's my favorite day to come to NYU because the traffic is like non-existent. So a disclaimer, and by means of introduction, a little bit about who I am and why the topic. So the first disclaimer is that whenever I'm asked to speak for any Yarfe Kala, for any YU function, that is through REITs or other of the yeshiva arms of the yeshiva university, I say, I'm a psychologist. Although I'm the dean of a school of Jewish education, my specialty is in psychology, not in Jewish thinking or Jewish thought. But one of the great discoveries this late in my career, after many, many years working in other places and coming to YU in the past 10 years, has been being able to finally put together being a from person and my psychological experience and background. And so what I hope to share with you today is both a threat and a psychology lens on the issues of bystander phenomena and bystander inaction in particular. My interest in this is not esoteric. I've spent the past over a dozen years working in schools, first in the public sector and now much more in Jewish day schools, on bully prevention. And what's the kesher, what's the connection between bully prevention and bystander inaction? So the beginning of bullying research and bully prevention, anti-bullying research, began in Norway, of all places, in the late 1990s, when Dan Olveus, a Norwegian psychologist, was called on to help Norwegian schools address the issue of bullying after a number of suicides. And what Olveus discovered was that 85% of all bullying is witnessed by peers, and that it turns out that it is not so easy to change bullies, and it is not so easy to change victims, but that if you work in a whole school context and change the bystanders, those witnesses of bullying, into pro-social agents who, when they see somebody teased, when they see somebody deliberately left out, belittled, humiliated, they stand up. It's in bullying research now, it's even called upstanding as opposed to bystanding, that it makes a huge difference. And Dan Olveus was able to achieve reductions of 50 and 75% of bullying in Norwegian schools. Now, since the late 90s until today, bullying research and anti-bullying programming has expanded internationally. No one has ever achieved the same level of success as the Norwegian programs. We could spend hours talking about why that is. Maybe they're just nicer in Norway than in other places in the world. The U.S., by the way, scores relatively low internationally on the scale in terms of our success in bully prevention. But this issue of bystander inaction and why bystanders don't engage and how we can help bystanders engage is something I have struggled with after visiting, you know, I don't even want to count how many, hundreds of classrooms, usually middle school classrooms, and confronting students with the question of, well, what are you going to do the next time you see something? Now, in the secular world, the only discussion I was allowed to have around this was the kind of generic moral discussion about what is our social duty as, you know, a child of the universe. But in Jewish schools, we have enormous halachic and hashkafic support for the notion of social responsibility and for what we are required, I have to do, when we are in a bystander position. And I'll share with you what you have in your source materials, some of the most basic sources. And again, I leave it to my rabbinic colleagues to learn these out on the inside and in the careful way necessary. But I want to just give you the benefit of our Jewish heritage, which we in some ways take very much for granted, but is the underpinning of bystander action, supports bystander action. Then I'll share with you the psychological phenomena that make it difficult to be an upstanding bystander, and some Torah examples, really some shining examples of where Jewish figures' Torah life took us beyond those psychological constraints and allow us to become socially responsible bystanders. Before I even look at the source material, if I say the name Kitty Genovese, how many people in the room know the story? Yeah, it's an age-defining. Kitty Genovese was a woman who was brutally attacked in New York, was stabbed, I believe, 50 times. There were over 30 bystanders, all of whom heard her cries and screams. Nobody called the police.
Kitty Genovese, right.
Nobody called the police. Now, you don't have to go back so far as Kitty Genovese. One video clip that I show all the time to students is a video clip that happened about 3 years ago in Australia. It made all of the news, so you may have seen it. It's a video of a very large middle school boy taking a smaller middle school boy who apparently has been teasing him for months and months and months and slamming him to the ground. Now, what is very interesting when you watch this video, which other kids picked up on even before I did, is what's the most disturbing thing? Well, other kids were taking this video on their cell phones, and nobody went and called a grown-up. They just videotaped it and posted it on, you know, Facebook or YouTube or whatever, but nobody did anything. And the adolescents get that right away. Like, why are they taking a video of this? Why isn't anybody getting help? That kid was just slammed to the ground. And I think it was last year or the year before, Cory Booker was mayor of Newark, yeah? Cory Booker's a Newark mayor. Was incensed at the fact that a person had been beaten in Newark for a $5, he was held up for $5, was beaten, and nobody called for help. There was an audience, there were people watching, nobody got help. So this is a phenomena that isn't just in the history books. It's happening, it's very real, and it's happening now. So what does Torah law tell us? So the first source that you have there is from Vayikra, and it is the classic source from which we derive our chayav, our chayuv, to act as a bystander, the very last segment of these psukim, says that we can't stand idly by the blood of the neighbor. Al tamod al dam re'acha. This is the classic source that is brought saying that we are not permitted to be idle bystanders and to say, you know, look, not my problem. It's not my tzuris. We have to do something. And the Rav talked about this. He talked about our need to protect human rights, that these obligations are implicit in human existence. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks talks about it as our partnering with Hashem, the great creator, who gave us freedom for more than any other reason to allow us the empathic... Do you want one?
Oh, you have.
to reach out to others. And the second source that generally underscores this notion of social responsibility for the other comes in the very generic statement that we should do that which is right and good. Now, I will tell you, as a parenting expert and as an educator, if I walked into a class or spoke to a group of young children and said, do that which is right and good, that would be very poor parenting. It would be very poor teaching. Why? It's too vague. Is what you think is right and good and what I think is right and good the same? If I'm four, I think what's right and good is playing in the chocolate pudding, even on your white couch. I think that's perfectly right and good. So, you know, it's a very vague statement. And the Mefarshim explain to us the reason for this vagueness. The Ramban says in his commentary that there is absolutely no way that the Torah could predict in advance all the instances that we would be challenged with to do the right thing. It can't possibly give us a list. Do that which is right and good means A, B, C, D, E, because it can't predict what you're going to be confronted with in life. But the psukim go on to give us some specific examples. So we have both the general rule, do what's right and good, and then the more specific, the lashon hara, don't be a talebearer, don't take vengeance, and al tamod adam re'acha, don't stand idly by the blood of your neighbor. That's just one example of doing that which is right and good. Rabbi Mark Dretsch, writing extensively about social responsibility and this notion of al tamod al dam re'acha in the context of abuse in the Jewish community, says that the very word ta'amod, stand, is a reminder that we can't be passive. That simply saying, well, you know, it wasn't about me, I didn't engage, is forbidden in Jewish law. We are not allowed to stand by. We are compelled to act in some way or another. And if we look at the Rambam and others, I have a source here from a doctor of law at Tel Aviv University, looking at the torts law and the legal ramifications of this, it's very, very clear what our obligation is. If you look at the translation of the Rambam here, if a person is able to save another and doesn't, we are over on al tamod al dam re'acha. If we see somebody drowning, being attacked by individuals, by animals, and although able either to do it myself or to hire somebody to help you, if I'm able to do that and I don't, then I am a transgressor. And the Ramban goes on to say that one might argue, well, it's not that I committed an act that would cause me to be beaten or flogged. It doesn't have that legal standing because I didn't do anything to you. In fact, I did nothing. The Ramban goes on to say that even though there's no flogging because there's no commission here, it's an act of omission, it is a serious offense because if one destroys the life of a single Israelite, it is regarded as though he destroyed the whole world. So if you stand by, you don't help, and if you preserve, it's as if you saved the entire world. And again, you have a discussion of the legality after that from Aaron Kirshenbaum, professor of law at Tel Aviv University, the Herzliya professor there, who talks about the fact that not only are we required to step in, but even if we are aware of a danger to someone's life, we are chayav, we are obligated. If we know that someone is going to be attacked and we do nothing, even we're not witness to it, but we're aware of the danger and we do nothing. Obviously, for someone who works in the field of bully prevention, this is so critical for me to be able to say to educators, to children, this is our Jewish obligation. If we know that a group of girls are about to attack another group of girls, verbally, socially, another girl, we are obligated to do something about it. We can talk later, if we have time, about what to tell kids to do about it, because it's complex. But let's shift for a moment to the question of, so we're chayev, we're obligated. This is critical to who we are as Jews, but why do we not do this? Why are there so many Kitty Genovese stories and other stories of Jews and others? What's the social psychology behind being a bystander, and what allows us to act or not act? There's a show, if you ever have the opportunity to watch, WABC News does it, called What Would You Do? Have you ever seen it? They basically take very classic psychological experiments and they do them in real life and see what would people do. One of the ones that I've seen actually is done around this time of year. It was videoed in Scarsdale or one of the Westchester little towns, little hamlets, and they have an actor who appears to be inebriated, on the public street, attempting to get into his car. What will bystanders do? Clearly inebriated person trying to get into a car. And many bystanders do nothing, but there are a subset who say, come on, give me the keys. Now, interestingly, but not so surprising, how the drunk person is dressed makes a difference. If he's an upscale guy versus looking homeless, what do you think? Which is more likely? You're more likely to help the upscale looking guy. Do you want to know what they, and they did it both with a guy and with a woman, and there was no difference between whether people came to the aid, whether it was male or female, until they added something to the story. Can you guess what they added that increased bystanders' engagement?
Children.
When the drunk person was about to put children into the car and drive off, more people engaged. And we'll talk about that in a minute, about some of the factors that are more likely to engage us and some of those that are not. So one of the factors that gets in the way, and it happened on that street where they were doing this videotape, is an issue of conformity. That as human beings, it is very uncomfortable for us to go against the tide. Solomon Asch, in the 50s, interested in understanding the power of Nazi propaganda, did an amazing and remarkably simple experiment. He said, I'm going to test your perception. I'm going to show you a line. I didn't draw it so well. And I'm going to ask you which of four other lines are its identical match. The answer's obvious, right? The only possible answer, even with my lousy drawing, is A. And he brought people into a room like this, and they sat in a row, and he asked person one, person two, what answer? And person one said C, and person two said C, and three said C, 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 C. And when we got to person number nine, person nine, first time around, said A. And they did this for multiple trials, the same task. And what happened in 30% of the cases, the person in chair number nine eventually answered C. Eventually caved to peer pressure, to conformity. The wall of incorrectness trumped what you knew, simple, was right. And it's amazing, and it's absolutely chilling. You can watch videotapes of the original Solomon Asch experiment, and now like every high school psychology student and college student redoes this experiment. You can see endless versions of it on YouTube. But the people who sit, what Asch didn't tell everyone is that people in chairs 1 through 8 are my confederates. I've paid them to all give the same wrong answer. And the findings are the same, by the way, whether you test housewives or PhDs, whether they're young people or older people, it doesn't matter. The human psyche doesn't like being the single lone voice of reason, even amidst craziness. We don't like it. It's incredibly uncomfortable. And what you see when you watch the videos and when you interview people afterwards who've been in chair number nine is they say things like, I began to doubt myself. I began to question al Talmud al Damri. I thought, maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe my understanding of the Rambam, maybe I don't have it right. Maybe I'm not really obligated. Or they just couldn't take what it required to be the lone voice of reason. It was just too hard, and so I gave up. Maybe I misunderstood the task. Maybe I'm not supposed to say the one that's right. So doubt, depression, all result. What could increase the likelihood that the person in chair 9 is going to go against that wall of conformity is any chink in the armor, any little glitch. So even if the person in the third chair answers D, another clearly wrong answer, we increase the likelihood that the person in chair 9 is going to give the right answer. Anything that breaks this huge conformity. Now, what does this have to do with bystander inaction? If you've ridden a subway, if you've been in an airport, you know, you are one of a sea of lemmings, you know, all going about your business, going through your security check, whatever. And if a piece of paper is on the floor and 10 people walk past that piece of paper,
the 11th person walks past too. They don't do anything. Years ago, post 9/11, I was traveling in, coming back, flew back into JFK, and I'm waiting to get my bags, and I see an unattended bag under a chair in the waiting area. And I also see that there are, army guys in fatigue, security guys with a dog. And I go over to them and I say, there's an unattended package there. And they say, you're like the fifth person who told us that. We've already sniffed it out. It's okay, but, you know, a squad's coming to take it away. I was so relieved that I was the fifth person that had told them. It gave me renewed, faith in the human ability, because it meant that we didn't all just say, well, somebody else did it. It's somebody else's responsibility, or why should I be the one to do it? No one else is doing it. So that's, number one issue is the issue of conformity. Where do we see a struggle with and a break from conformity in a Torah or Tanakh example? So one that just struck me, and there are many. Somebody once accused me when I gave this shiur. They said, well, you didn't share every example of bystander phenomena in Tanakh. I said, I couldn't possibly. There aren't enough hours in the day. There are numerous. I just gave you one for each one of them, and it's one that spoke to me. It's by no means necessarily the best. But it may be that the first time I was preparing this, it might have been that we were in Bamidbar. I don't remember. But reading the story of Kalev and the Meraglim and the spies. So there's a very, very interesting set of psukim here that first talks about that the singular is used, the Yavo. V'yalu b'negev v'yavo. And they came. It's a group of people, the Meraglim. They came into Hebron. So at first, according to, this is Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, he brings down from Sota that Kalev went there to pray on the grave of the Avot for strength to stand up against his Hebron, against his row of seven people before him, eight people before him, who are all going to give one answer. The Avo is in the singular to indicate that up until that point, the Meraglim were of one voice. They were of one mind. As one man, they have unanimous mind and purpose. And Shimshon Raphael Hirsch goes on to say it was because of Kalev's courage and because of his influence that he's allowed to do that. But look at two psukim later, and now we see that Kalev is singular. And how is he referred to? Kalev is referred to as Avdi. He's my servant. He's God's servant. How does Shimshon Raphael Hirsch explain the separation out of Kalev from the other Meraglim? His faithful, fearless standing up. Basically, he was in the row of Meraglim, and he was the one who said no. Gives him the highest designation of a human being working for God. And he says Hirsch says he had a different way of looking things and a different will, which saved him from the sin of conformity, the sin of his comrades, all of whom gave in to that negative feeling. So conformity is one psychological phenomenon we have to address. The other issue is bystander apathy. We know that when we are in a group and the entire group faces a challenge, witness something negative, that we do a cheshbon, we do a consideration of, well, it's partly conformity, what is everyone else doing? But it's partly an issue of ownership. Is this my job? Why isn't anybody else doing this job? On a separate note, by the way, there's an issue of assigning both blame and credit that we always, always are inaccurate when we determine our own contribution to a situation. We over or underrepresent. We are never accurate. So in terms of a problem, we're going to underrepresent. I don't contribute very much to, pollution. I'm not a big polluter. If it's in terms of credit, the Hanukkah party, I did everything. We overrepresent, And the way that people know that this happens, by the way, is that if you ask people who work together, for example, or people in a family, about a shared responsibility, you know, okay, so that trip that you took, what percentage of it was your responsibility and you took care of? How much of it happened because of you? When you add up the numbers, it always comes up to more than 100%. It's not possible. Everybody gives themselves more credit, or it adds up to less than 100% in terms of blame because no one will accept enough blame. But we can greatly increase our accuracy about that if before we answer the question, how much credit do I get for something happening? We become much more accurate if we first think about how much credit someone else gets. So if you simply say, before I answer how much credit I get for making that beautiful simcha, let me think first, how much credit does my husband get? Does my mother-in-law, does this one? If I think about someone else first, I'll be more accurate about my own contributions. I actually think that has enormous relevance for spirituality, because in terms of our relationships, ben adam l'makom, it speaks to, if I don't think first about that which I really have to say, the responsibility, it's in God's hands, then I'm going to overemphasize my contribution. And really, it's, you know, I'm not being realistic unless I say, really, most of this came from Hashem Yitbarach, it didn't come from me. So it's just a little aside about responsibility. Bystander apathy. Whether it's the Kitty Genovese story, whether it is other examples that have been repeated, New York City subways had a huge flurry of research. They would go on a New York City subway, they would equip it with all kinds of cameras, and an actor would pretend to be ill. And they would record how many people on a subway come to aid, don't come to aid. If you think it's New York, and it's just, well, of course in New York people don't do it. No, it's been replicated with all different kinds of places and experiences. And the reality is that in groups, bystanders are not likely to come forward. One person in a group is not likely to come forward. It's actually been labeled as a phenomena of bystander apathy. There are certain things that make it worse, and there are certain things that make it better. So some of the phenomena that make it worse is when it's more ambiguous. If it's not clear whether I'm going to be helpful or not, I'm less likely to step in. If it's not clear whether this is something that is safe or I could or should be doing, I'm less likely to step in. Although we know, we occasionally hear of these unbelievable heroic stories. Remember a few years ago, there was the man who gave charge of his children on a subway platform to a stranger while he jumped onto the tracks to save someone who was ill. I mean, that gives you an example of what human nature is capable of when we go beyond our bystander apathy. But how many of us in that condition would have said, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can save him. I'm not a doctor. What am I going to do? The train's coming quickly. This could all be for nothing. I can't help. Ambiguity makes it worse. If conformity has been primed, what do I mean by primed? Priming is a psychological phenomena that refers to anything that creates neurologically a predisposition for us to behave in a certain way. For example, if I have you read a list of words like elderly, aging, illness, sedentary, osteoarthritis, cane, walker, and wheelchair, you will take longer to walk to that door when I time you than if I have you read the list of words that says athlete, healthy, vigorous, etc. You get the point. Priming, simply putting an idea in our neural substrate, makes it more likely that we're going to behave in a way that's consistent with that idea. So if I'm primed for conformity, if I'm primed, okay, class, now we're all going to stay together on this class trip, right? everybody is going to be, or we're in Israel and we're with the tour guide and the tour says, everybody stay with me, follow me now. We've been primed for groupthink. We've been primed to do everything as, you know, a multi-legged but single-headed beast. Now we witness something, we're less likely, any one of us, to reach our hand out to help someone in need because the group has been primed for conformity. If the group that we belong to has very high status, we're in a group that has high status, and that high status group is not acting. Or if we are in a situation where we see someone, we see the President of the United States, or we see an officer of the law, we see someone who acts in a bystander apathetic way, we're also more likely to be apathetic. If we see, you know, lahavdil, if we see someone with great status step in and help, then we're going to be more engaged in doing that which the other person has done. And interestingly, we are more likely to be apathetic and to be refrain from action when we're with people who are like us. We're less likely to be good bystanders when we're next to our best friend than when we're alone. We're more likely to be good bystanders in a group of strangers than we are in a group of our friends. That's a little bit chilling, and again, given that I do a lot of work with bully prevention in schools with children, this is something I have enormous, you know, struggles with, because I'm asking kids to do the right thing even when all their buddies and friends are not. And it's a huge, huge challenge. We already know that, you know, what weakens more apathy also, by the way, if there's ambiguity about whether the other person is really suffering. So if it's unclear, the same show, by the way, that the What Would You Do show did another hidden camera. They do hidden cameras all the time, where they had a couple fighting in a park, and what would bystanders do when they passed the couple fighting, where the fighting actually got violent. Now here, when it was the male attacking the female, people stepped in. They either told the male he had to stop, or they tried to rescue the female, or they went and called somebody on their cell phone. When it was the female attacking the male, and she attacked him, I mean, she was beating him up, nobody stepped in to help, including off-duty police officers who walked past. What was their explanation? Well, how much hurt could a woman do? How much could she really hurt him? So the ambiguity that I don't think that victim's really suffering led to bystander apathy. It's ambiguous. It's not clear that someone is being hurt. Our apathy is also increased if there's a personal cost to us for helping. Even though we read in the Ramban and the Ramban, we have a chayav, and even at personal cost and expense, even if we have to hire somebody to rescue you from drowning because we don't swim, we are chayav to do that. We're obligated to do that. We are less likely from a psychological point to do it if there's some cost to us of helping. It doesn't cost me anything to pick up some litter off the ground, to be a responsible bystander, and to leave my area neat, but it might cost me something to intervene with a couple that's fighting in a park. I might be afraid for my own safety. I might be afraid I'm going to be the next one punched, right? And lastly, there's more increased apathy if I'm not clear my action will help. If I, you know, it's very clear if there is an elderly person who needs help crossing the street, I know exactly what to do. I can help them. But if someone is struggling and I don't know what to do to help, or I'm not clear what I have to offer would make a positive difference, I'm going to be more apathetic. Okay. I think that the one of the greatest examples of a struggle with bystander apathy, and again, I'm simplifying a very complex story, are the lines from the Megillah, from Megillat Esther. That we all know the story, that Esther is ensconced in the palace. The Jews, the edict against the Jews has been advanced by evil Haman. And Mordechai confronts Esther and says, you need to come forward and you need to plead for the Jews. And Esther says, I don't know if I can, and she balks, and they're all different, again, a complex story of what was at stake for Esther in doing this. But I think the words of Mordechai are really astounding in underscoring how critical bystander action can be. When Mordechai says, "Umi yodea im le'et kazot higat l'machut," and who knows, maybe it was for this moment that you were raised to royalty. Who knows that at any moment that any one of us are in a bystander situation where it was perhaps this is the meaning of our life. This is what we were meant for. This is why Hashem put us in this place at this time to make a difference in someone's life. What an incredibly powerful kind of bumper sticker of opportunity and seeing ourselves as socially responsible agents of change that we can carry with us. And the last phenomenon I want to get to before we run out of time that interferes with bystander action has to do with dehumanization of victims. We know from extensive psychological research that if you see someone victimized over and over again, you begin to create a hierarchy where they are seen as less than human and therefore not deserving of your intervention. The classic psychological experiment that documented this was the Stanford Prison Experiment, which was done at Stanford University. It took undergrads who volunteered knowing that they would be randomly assigned to be either prisoners or prison guards in a makeshift prison in the basement of the psychology building at Stanford. The guards were picked up and given khakis and t-shirts to wear. The prisoners were picked up. They were given jeans and t-shirts, put in handcuffs, and brought to the basement of the psychology building, where they were supposed to spend, I think, a two-week period. The study was ended early, 5 days. The individuals who were guards were given no other instruction about what they were to do. But what ensued very, very quickly was a level of dehumanization of victims that was so cruel and unexpected that the people running the experiment had to shut it down. These were these were students who were on the same campus, who had no animosity against each other until they were created as victims. And what happened was the guards would set a policy that would be harsh, which would cause prisoners to revolt or to express their distaste for the policy, which would cause the guards to become stricter and more punitive. And when the study ended, there were people in solitary confinement, people who had their clothes removed from them, people who were being humiliated, really horrible things that were enacted. And we, again, don't have to look far from our own history to think about, if you want to, in modern times, think about the treatment of Jews during the Holocaust. If we want to think about the Abu Ghraib pictures that are, I think, clear examples of dehumanization, of what humans are capable of doing when we can kind of segment another individual out of the human condition and say that person isn't the same as me, they're not B'Tselem Elohim, and therefore they're dehumanized and I can treat them in that way. Again, in terms of a Torah example, I think the classic and one of the most powerful is Moshe Rabbeinu's transcendence above this, a man who is raised in the lap of royalty in the house of the Egyptian Paro. But what happens when the fact that there are people living in slavery, Moshe could have been totally detached from. He's living a life of privilege. But what happens when he sees the Eved Ivri being beaten, the Hebrew slave being beaten? The words of the Pasuk say that I'm looking for where it was, and he saw no man, ki ein ish, that there was no one there. And we know that Moshe acted then. I read recently a parish, I'm trying to remember whose it was, who said this notion of that there wasn't a man there is not just Moshe looking that the coast is clear, what Moshe Rabbeinu saw was the dehumanization of victims and conformity and bystander inaction. He saw that there was no other human being that was going to step forward and do something here, and if not for me, then who? If not now, when? You know, the famous Hillel saying, and this was his opportunity. What bystander action and social responsibility really requires is empathy. It requires that we put ourselves in the shoes of another person, feel their pain, experience their struggle, and say, I can't stand by and watch this. I'm going to do something about it. So I'm going to close here so I have time for questions, and they want to give people time to get to the next year, with two thoughts. We've seen that we're chayav. We've also seen, from a Torah perspective, you could argue from a democratic and moral perspective that we're also chayav, but clearly from a Torah perspective, as bystanders, we have a responsibility, and the responsibility, by the way, extends beyond simply Jews. We have an obligation when we see suffering to do something about it. We've also seen that from a psychology point of view and from social psychological phenomena, that it requires really the best of us. It requires us to be godlike and beyond sometimes our typical human constraints in order to go beyond those psychological forces that hold us back when we're bystanders. Einstein said that the world's a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it. The words of Elie Wiesel, I think you have also in your, you may have a closing quote, yeah, of Elie Wiesel, who says, you know, I swore to never to be silent whenever and wherever human beings endure suffering and humiliation. We must take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. We just finished lighting the magical, miraculous lights of Hanukkah that lit our homes and that inspired us about what small things can grow into amazing things. I am really privileged to work with Jewish children in Jewish schools to light them as bystanders that can take action and can bring light to the world. Questions, comments, thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you so much. My name is Sarah Robinson. I'm a senior at Stern College. My question for you is in response to a contemporary issue, and that is the racial divide between whites and blacks in the United States today. Given the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, and what you're saying here, do you think Jews have a place at such protests? Why or why not?
So the I want to broaden the question. I think that Jews have a moral obligation and have long, by the way, been involved in civil rights efforts and struggles for others in powerful and potent ways. What each individual chooses to do to be an upstanding bystander is not for me to advise. This is an instance where there are protests that I feel are sometimes extremely important and helpful in all areas of protest, and there are others that you feel like, you know what, better the efforts be directed in lobbying or in creating legislation or in donating funds. So I don't have the geopolitical answers to what we need to do, but I know that sitting idly by when things are happening in our world is not the Jewish way. It never has been the Jewish way. And I hope it will continue that we are exemplars of social action and social responsibility, both in our communities and beyond.
Yeah. I too thank you. I want to ask you a question as an educator of educators. How do you deal with this? I'm not asking this to be provocative. I'm considering this a safe space, and I really am wrestling with this. So talk about dehumanization of victims. Sometimes, maybe I don't understand it correctly, sometimes our own halakha or hashkafa directs us to think of non-Jews in a different kind of category. For example, the house falls on somebody on Shabbat. Okay, if they're Jewish, you challah Shabbat, save them. If they're not, you keep walking. Or maybe you ask someone else to. So, how do you, I mean, this is very ennobling kind of stuff, at the same time, there's this other equally legitimate, you know, resources that tell us that non-Jews, we treat them differently. So, as a, again, I'm not asking you to,
right,
even,
so
to explain it, but how do you teach it?
I think that this is a question that I get on so many different areas. Of, you know, how do you teach hashkafically different, difficult issues? How do you teach things when perhaps your hashkaf is different than the students you're teaching? I think that one of the most important things we do as educators is share our passion and what we truly believe in. And I think that that has to it can't put halakha aside, but it has to go side by side with halakha. So that while you may be exactly right, and I'm certainly not going to give psak on what you do or don't do if a house falls on a Jew or a non-Jew on Shabbat, that I leave to my rabbinic colleagues, but I think that we can educate children about the challenges that halakha guides us to a point, guides us in all areas of our life, and it is a way to make us the best people we can be. There are also challenges at times that halakha allows us to consider, forces us to consider, forces us to confront. In exactly the same way that halakha might make a distinction between a goy and a Jew, there are other halakhas that I suspect would challenge that distinction, or would say, yes, but the commandment not to kill is not only Jews. You can't kill anyone. You know, the commandment not to steal, there are certain things that are broad and there are certain things that are more specific. So I think it's delicate, but I think that there are ways, and I think one of the most important things that we do consistently at Asmiyeli, you use the word safe space, is to teach educators that it is their job to create the space for Jewish thought and growth. It is not their job to answer every Jewish question. We have a Gemara that is filled with questions and answers and questions that are still unresolved after years of responsa and discussion. We have a Beis Medrash that is filled with lively and vibrant argument on a daily basis. We don't have to go into our classroom and say to our children, this is it, black and white, this is the answer. We can say, this, you're raising a really important question. What could we read that would help us understand this better? Where could we peel the onion back in other layers that would let us look at this in a really careful and nuanced way? And, you know, obviously, that has to be developmentally tied, because you can't do that the same in a kindergarten classroom as you can in a high school classroom. So I appreciate the question and the challenge in the question. I also think that we can, in developmentally appropriate ways, say there's always something that we can do as bystanders. We have the chayav and we also have the opportunity. We have an opportunity to make a difference in a positive way in people's lives, and we can focus on that universal of how we can find ways to do that. Yeah.
First of all, I'm sorry I came late. You are absolutely phenomenal.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. My question is, how much does history come into play when we are bystanders? Do we forget things that have passed? For instance, the question that the young lady raised with civil rights today. Well, if I'm not mistaken, right after the civil rights movements, the blacks turned completely against the Jews. We went through one of the most historically depressing times. How does this fit into it?
So there is, again, my specialty is a psychologist, not as a historian. I am sure that history plays a role, both personally and collectively, so that there are, but it plays an indeterminate role. I'll tell you what I mean. We are still blessed having amongst our midst survivors of the Holocaust. For a few fleeting years, we will be blessed with living testimony of the Holocaust. And if you've had the opportunity to meet survivors, you know that there are those survivors who carry with them an anger and a vengeance, a historical, you know, a determination that is palpable to this day, and there are others who carry with them an optimism and forgiveness that denies, you can't believe, given what they went through, where this comes from. So I think that one can have multiple responses to the same history. But do historical factors play a role? Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that we are not charged to be blind bystanders. We are not charged in any way to be historically blind bystanders that run to the aid of someone who has in the past been a mortal enemy and it endangers us. I think understanding the nuances of danger and where we can be helpful and where we cannot, by the same token, we are not charged to be vengeful often. I heard a shiur, I can't remember who recently gave a shiur about the whole notion of vengeance and the limited times that we are charged to exact vengeance. It's not a typical, we're a tzedek pursuers. We pursue justice, but not necessarily vengeance. So very, very good points. Thank you all very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
How are you?
Good. I don't know how to turn it on. This one's on too.
Yeah.
Okay.